You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. This week on the pod, it's all about the filmmakers behind the film, Tatina. And today's guest is producer Tanya Skad Ryerson. Let me share a little about the film before we begin, in case you haven't seen it. It's based on the thrilling story of polar explorer Roald Amundsen and Italian engineer Umberto Nobile. Tatina tells a truish story of glory and defeat, seen through the eyes of the street dog that became the world's first four-legged celebrity who traveled to the North Pole in a Zeppelin. Sounds fun, right? It is. I love this movie. The film is hand-drawn in 2D. Oh, 2D. Interspersed with real-life footage. And it was produced in Norway and Belgium. So grab a beverage of your choice. Sketch while you listen if you like. And enjoy.
Hello, I'm Tanya Skad Ryerson. I'm a producer with an Oslo-based company called Mikrofilm. And we do mostly traditional animation, hand-drawn, frame by frame. But we've always also done some stop motion and other projects. Yes, I'm a producer, so I'm not creative at all. No, I'm kidding. But I work very closely with the creatives. And that's what makes me my heart jump, I think. There's a lot of tasks that go into being a producer. You know, it's a lot to do with financing and Excel sheets and planning and strategies and market strategies and communication strategies. And, you know, but and all of that can be fun as well. But to be in the studio with the artists and watch the magic happen and to participate in daily discussions on line thicknesses or the choice of color or, you know, sitting in the voice recording with the actors. And I think that creative part of the process is definitely what makes it fun to be an animation producer.
You're mentioning that you sometimes are in those meetings where like deciding line width, like something so small, like a decision. And like, there's the joke where it's like, this could have been an email, but like, you can't have like that creative conversation through email as easily as in person and looking at it together.
I think in animation, it's all about the details.
Definitely.
You should never make a rash decision. And because there can be so many consequences and you need to test it like a thing. I say line sort of as a joke, because in 2D, that's something we spend a lot of time and probably too much time discussing, but also it has great implication, not only for how the image will finally look on the big screen, but also how the production pipeline will be and how time consuming the animation and especially the cleanup will be. So this is something we spent a lot of time talking about and discussing and testing. And it sounds sort of silly and funny for people outside of animation, but it's really vital.
Yeah. And pointing out that like, it's not just a meeting about line width, it's what comes after this, whatever decision you make there, you have to put the people on it to make it happen after that, scheduling wise and budget wise. So that's really interesting to like hear kind of like what's going through your mind as you're having this discussion with your team.
Yes, exactly. There's so many implications. And one thing is sort of what looks good. And another thing is what's doable. And also it's important always to test things, you know, to see it, because you just, when the team is working on a Cintiq and you watch it there, it's not the same as, you know, having it exported and in 4K and shown on the big screen. So you need to make sure you have fully thought through vision of what you're trying to achieve and how you're going to achieve it and if it's doable within your budget.
Yeah. So like, what are those conversations with like your director or leads like when they want to do something that's seemingly impossible, but they feel really strongly about it? Like, how do you make it work, or what kind of conversation do you have next?
It's very different from project to project, but mainly, I mean, we are an auteur driven studio, so we will never sort of sit here with a, you know, between the two producers and, you know, come up with some idea of what could be a nice animated film and then go out to find the right director. It's, we want the ideas to come from a passionate artist. And in that sense, the artist is sort of everything for us. And that also means that we try in every way to sort of fulfill their vision or make or facilitate for them to fulfill their vision. So generally, we will always strive towards fulfilling the director's wishes. But then, of course, sometimes there, you know, it's not possible, and you need to sort of have that discussion. But usually, our with a couple of exceptions, our directors are experienced people who come from animation. Some have been animators, some have been designers. So they do understand the process, and they do understand the implication. So, and it's not in their interest either to ask for something you can't have or that will sort of hurt your budget. I cannot recall a single time where we've not come to an agreement. And it's usually not about two positioning, different positions fighting each other. It's usually, you know, sitting together, being in the same boat as a team, and just finding out how we can make something.
That's really cool to hear about. Yeah, because I feel like I've seen a scant conversations where like artists will be like, you know, frustrated with the production team for different reasons, usually schedule, but it's all been in like TV, which is super schedule, you know, driven and very quick turnaround. So I'm sure it's very different for an auteur driven studio.
Yeah, but of course these things happen as well. But then the conflict is usually is more between the production management and the director than with us as producers and the director, if you know what I mean. But of course these differences they come up. But the thing in animation is, you know, you make some choices quite early on, and then you sort of need to stick with these choices. And when the production management later find out that, you know, this was maybe not the best choice, you cannot sort of go back and change 20% of animation that's already done. So then you need to find other solutions. Then, you know, you might need to, you know, maybe you need to cut some images, or you need to, you know, do other things, or outsource stuff to cleaner or to cheaper countries, stuff like that. But you it's sort of when you've sort of made your decision, it's a lot of things are just too late.
It seems like you have a lot of creative decision making along the way.
Yeah, and usually, you know, we always give the final word to the director, but we work with our directors for a long time. It takes a long time. You know, we do mostly short films. We've done two features, and now we're developing three more features. But for the short films as well, the development and the financing phase takes a long time. So we talk to them. You know, it's a long process where we are involved from day one. So there's a lot of creative discussions all the way.
So like, when did you realize you wanted to be a producer? Like, what's your origin story in getting into animation? Why animation? Why producing?
Yeah, that's sort of two different questions, I guess. Why producing? That's sort of, I sort of fought becoming a producer actively for many years, because I sort of knew that I would sort of be good at it, but I didn't want to do it. And that was basically because I was, to be honest, I was scared of the responsibility of, you know, the responsibility of a huge budget, etc.
Oh, yeah.
I found that very intimidating. But because I'm trained, I came to film through academic studies. I did the film history, film theory, bachelor, master, level. And then I loved film. I wanted to be in film, and I worked with festivals for many years, but I always felt that I wanted to be in production. And then I, you know, I have friends in film, and And people sort of tried to push me into being a producer. Oh, you could be my producer. No, you would be good at it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I was fighting it because, as I said, I was scared of the responsibility because it is a big responsibility and it is a very all consuming job. But then I came to animation sort of by accident a little bit, for me, it was less about coming to animation and more about coming to Microfilm, this company, because I love the work that they did. I love the atmosphere. We shared the same, not only visual taste, but the same political views, the same artistic aspirations. I had been working then in documentary for some time, which I also love, but I felt that I'm a very visual person and I felt that a lot of documentary filmmakers, they're not that interested maybe in the visual side of film production, so that it wasn't sort of fulfilling enough. And then I knew people here at Microfilm and they asked me, Lisa, my now producer colleague, asked me to come along as a production manager originally, and I did that, and that's how I sort of learned animation, sort of at least, and that's how I started to learn about animation. And then I could sort of grow into producing, and I sort of understood that, not only would it be fun, but it would also be sort of manageable when you're producing an animated film. It's still a lot of stress and the budget and the responsibility. But first of all, I'm not alone. I'm working with my producer colleague who's brilliant at these things. But also in animation, it's not like, something goes wrong on one shooting day and it's $20,000+ out the window. And, it's a sort of a different kind of stress. And that's sort of something I felt that I could survive in a way. So I think for me, I have a lot of abilities that's good for producing, but I don't think I myself could sort of survive as a producer if I was to work in live action, because it's horrifying, I think. Very scary.
I get that feeling. It's like, especially with the raising funds, it seems very daunting. And like, from what I understand, you guys have art grants over there and nice systems in place to try to find funding? Or is there an additional piece where you have to schmooze with people who have money to get funding? Because I don't know.
Both yes and no. The US is so different from Europe. Because as you said, we have, it's grants, but you have your national film institutes. Right. And then you have your regional film centers and private investors. And then, in animation with the big budgets, you need to work across the borders. So you work, with someone else's film institute, etc. But that's handled by your co-producer. So you sort of raise money within your own country, and then it's up to your partner to raise their money in France or in Belgium or whatever. And actually, financing itself is not scary. That's sort of fun. The scary part is we know as producers how much money we can get. There's a maximum. So you know that this fund won't give me more than this. This fund won't give me more than that, etc. So the scary part is whether you've been able to land a budget that you can finance, and if that budget is realistic. And usually, you're not able to finance your budget, and then that you're starting a production with perhaps a bit optimistic. You always sort of lack at least 10%. And, being a short film with like 100,000 euros of a budget, or a feature film at 8.5 million euros, you always have the feeling that you lack 10%. And that feeling comes back to haunt you throughout the production. And it's, that's sort of the scary part.
Yeah. So when you're checking schedules and budget, is it like a weekly check while production is happening just to make sure you're on the path?
Yes, absolutely. And luckily we have line producers for that. So it's not us as sort of producers who do that daily check. That's the line producers collaborating with the production managers. And then they will report to you and let you know how it's done, but on short films, which is what we mainly do, we need to do it ourselves. Mm. And then we try to be on top of everything. But sometimes you realize a little bit too late that things are going over schedule, over budget. And yeah.
Are there any other differences between line producers and producers? And it seems like, just having talked to a lot of people, like there are some things that remain pretty much the same, but there are some things that differ per like what your studio mm-hmm. makes.
Yeah, and I think also that it's different between country to country, what you call the different, you know, in some countries, executive producer is like a very important person. And in a lot of countries, executive producer is just a title you give to someone to make them happy, you know.
Right, but that exists over here too.
But it doesn't really mean anything, you know.
Yeah.
But the line producer, what the line producer does here, it's basically to, they can be part of doing the budgeting, doing the breakdown, etc. And then they are responsible for sort of the day-to-day following up of the budget. Well, as producers, the job is so much bigger. You're on the, you know, the, even though the film comes from creative director, the producer is the one that sort of works on the film the most for the longest period of time. You know, you're on the project from the first seat, the first idea, and then you together with the director and the scriptwriter, you develop the idea, you find out if it's feasible or not, you sort of nurture it, decide on whether you're going to do it or not, what kind of audience, how it's going to be done, and then it's your job to find out who are we going to work with, which countries, which studios, which talents. And then how are we going to finance it? And then you have to finance it. And then you follow the production on a daily basis, or at least a weekly basis, depending on how you organized it throughout the production. And then it's also your job to handle the communication, the distribution. Of course, you have a sales agent, you have distributors, but you still take active part in sort of shaping the way we talk about this film. Which images do we show? What kind of feeling do we want to convey? Sitting in with the trailer editor, you know, and then you talk to the journalist. And now we finished. I had Bettina a year ago, and I'm still here talking to you about it.
Right.
So I've been talking about this film now for 10 years. So it's sort of a huge job, and but as a line producer, you're sort of, you don't develop the project. It's not your baby in that sense. You are hired and you do an extremely, extremely important job that I would never be able to do. So I have all the respect in the world for them, and we totally rely on line producers. Yeah, it's sort of for a shorter period of time, and it's more about, you know, the practicalities and not necessarily like the huge vision.
I see. Yeah, it seems like you have so many plates spinning as you're working. Just hearing that you finished Tatina about a year ago and you're still talking about it, because that's something that I think a lot of people should really take in, because you can make art, but you also want it seen. Like, if you want it seen, these are things that you need to take into consideration. And I feel like your strategy for publicity has been amazing. When I was first like researching the movie after I watched it, you had articles on all these websites like announcing it and interviewing your people. So like, that can't be easy to like get that going. So like,
now you need to have a strategy, and you need to have it quite early. And that's what we did, was that we started to position the film quite early on, and we were lucky that some of the important animation sites, such as Cartoon Brew and Animation Magazine, that they liked the project, and especially Cartoon Brew has written a lot on it. So I think they liked it because of the style, because of the story, because it's not that often that you would see an artistic 2D film like this, and especially not from Northern Europe. So it had a lot of things going for it that sort of made them interested. And then, of course, when they have written about it once, then, of course, it's already on the radar. And when they highlight pitching forum and exciting projects that's going to be there. When they know this title from before, it's a bigger chance that your film is one of the films they were going to highlight. You just get the snowball gets rolling. So, but you need to, yeah, you need to have a clear strategy and think about what is sort of the unique selling points for my film. It can have something to do with the story. It can be something exciting about the director. It might be something, maybe there's some technical innovation. It could be a lot of different things, but you need to sort of know what they are and then sort of try to position that and sort of start to sell the stories quite early. But on the other hand, you don't want them to write too much too early, and so that everyone, you know, that you sort of used everything before the film is even released. And yeah, so that's of course also a balance. And then we were lucky as well because we worked with a sales agent who are a very, very, very good sales agent in France called Le Film de Losange. And they have all the contacts into the other mediums because we don't really have access to those journalists. We, for us, it's easier to reach out to the animation journalists. So then they could sort of sell and place the stories in that circuit, and we could sort of focus on the animation circuit.
Very cool.
And recently we've been working also with the Animation Showcase, Benoît Humbert, and he's brilliant, and he has also a lot of good connections. And so it's, you know, it's about finding the right angles, starting early, and then having good partners to help you with better networks than yourself, and then you expand your network as well. So
yeah. And when, you know, putting the strategy into play, like, did you have goals in mind? Like, I want international people to watch this, get an Oscar nomination. Like, what were kind of like your goals and how did you make them?
Yeah. No, that's, we've had an, absolutely. We had international ambitions from day one. That's the goal, because we are a very small country, you know, we're only, I don't know how many people we are, 6.7 million or something like that. So it's a very, very small market. So we always knew that we wanted the film to have a broader audience. Well, the film is sold all over Europe now, but I haven't really dealt with European communication that much outside of, you know, CP Frame, Squiggly, those animation sites, Screen. So it's been, we've communicated most in the Nordic countries and then in the US, with one exception, and that's Italy, because Italy is a very important country. It's a very important country for us because the story takes place largely in Italy. So there we've sort of tried to get interest quite early on as well. And the film actually opens in Italian cinemas today.
Oh, so, how fun! Yes, September 14th.
Yes, I'm very curious to see how it will be received. The critics, the reviews that I've read so far are very good, but how it's going to land with the audience is, of course, exciting and a little bit nerve-wracking. We'll see.
Yeah. Do you find, like, critics, it just seems like critics have this, like, really high bar. They're always, like, judging things, and it's not always the audience's, like, opinion.
Critics are, of course, scary. I think so far with the Tina, we've been super happy. I mean, in all the countries, people have been like, the critics have been like super supportive, and you know, it's been better received than we had ever dreamt of. But I see sometimes you can see a little, of course, it's harder in the big animation countries like France, you know, because they have so many high quality films coming out. So they sort of rate your film accordingly, but actually the French critics were super good, but they were not as overwhelming as the ones you have in Northern Europe, where they basically call it, you know, an instant classic and, you know, a triumph and, you know, like very big words. But in
well, those are all true as well.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. Well, thank you. But in France, it's more, yeah, it's good. It's actually quite good. You know, you get more. And what I've also seen now in Italy was that some of the critiques are fantastic, like over the moon enthusiastic. And then the other ones that were a bit more, yeah, that had to do with, you know, because we portray their story, their history in a very difficult phase. You know, it was during their fascist dictatorship under Mussolini. And our choice was to do the same as El Toro did in Pinocchio, that we sort of turn him into a dangerous man, but also sort of a clown. And for them, that's sort of hard. So I think I saw a couple of the film critics today that were a little bit, yeah, it's a beautiful film, but it's also maybe a little bit light, or it's a little bit too historically inaccurate. And I understand that point. I think it's a fair point. But it's also, you know, we have made the family film.
And you made the choice to not be historically accurate on some things. Like, yeah, and it's you have really magical sequences and the dog having hallucinations. Yes. Of course, there's some magical
Yeah, we have, you know, singing, dancing penguins. So it's obviously not trying to be historically correct, but I do understand that point of view as well, because it's a very painful part of their history. You know, so it's easier for us to take that lightly and turning it into something playful, and for them it feels a little bit different, and I do respect that. But for other Italian film critics, you know, that's what they sort of liked and said, you know, it was beautiful to see, you know, how it made fun. So I thought it was interesting to see that the reception is a little bit different in Southern Europe, as expected, and interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting to hear how like your animation industry works across Europe, and like what people see as the standard. And yeah, it's really cool to hear about. Like, so when you're deciding, like as a studio, what project to pursue next, do you kind of have like points that you look for? Do your directors have to pitch you ideas? Like, how does that go?
Yeah, it's the directors, they come to us with ideas, and then we go for them or we don't. That's basically it. And it's all about, you know, the passion and the potential. And I think there's not that, because sometimes we have outside sort of freelance directors coming to us with projects quite often, but it's not that many of those projects we end up taking on. Then it needs to be something special. But usually when the project come from our in-house people, because we have people here that, you know, they're directors, but they can also do design and work on other people's films and blah, blah, blah. So they're here every day, and then they direct their own shorts, you know, from time to time. And then hopefully move into feature film directors, which is the case with one of our directors now. And then it's up to them to sort of tell us pitch the story, but they know us very well. So it's very rarely, I cannot remember one single incident that and one of our internal people have pitched us an idea and we turned it down. Like, but it's usually, you know, you feel like, yeah, there's something here, but it's not there yet. And then you sort of develop it together. Or you try to finance it, and then it, you know, you understand that it's difficult, and sometimes, not often, but sometimes you sort of need to let a good idea go. But usually the people who are here, they know what we like, and when they are at the stage where they're able and ready, when the internal people here are pitching us ideas and they feel that they're at the stage where they can present it to us, they know us well enough to sort of bring us things that we like. It's not, you know, luckily we don't need to turn people down. It's usually, you know, they come to us with their hearts, and it's usually a gift, and it's, a joy to hear them present it.
Nice. Do you have any advice for, because a lot of people listening, like, want to develop and pitch shows. Do you have any advice for them? Like, having seen pitches and people talk about their dream project, what have you seen like work best? What to keep in mind, things like that?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends on, because I think your system is very different from us. Well, in Europe, it's very different. But what we do a lot is that we attend public pitches. When you're at festivals you're at the forums where you like cartoon movie, for instance, in France, where you present your project to a large audience. And that audience consists of potential co-producers. It consists of buyers, distributors, investors, sales agents, etc. And then you see there's sort of a formula to pitching, you know, that people will not always, but usually people will sort of follow the same structure. And I think that it's good when you're pitching a project to be aware of how to pitch, what ingredients need to be there, and to make sure that you mention all the essential, that if you're retelling the story, you shouldn't retell the full story, but just get people interested, but make sure that it's sort of understandable. And make sure that you communicate what stage you're on, what you're looking for, that what's the audience, the target group, the budget, all that you have all these things very clear, so that it's easy to get and also easy for people to understand if it's a place for them in this project, you know? But more than that, I think the most important thing is to see your passion. That you need to feel that the creator has a real passion for this project. And you need to understand why it's important for this person to do this specific project, and also why it should be important for me. One thing is what it's sort of about on a superficial level, but what is it really about? What's driving you? What's your motivation? I think that's super important. Because it's not interesting to hear just a good story. I need to understand why you're the person telling me this story. And, you know, so I think that's important. And also to have really, when you're in animation, we need really, really good visuals. And there's so many pitches out there with stuff that looks almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And there's so much, it's not that it's bad. It's just that it's boring. So I think in the same way as you should be aware of your sort of unique selling points when it comes to the content of your film or your series, you also need to define the unique selling points in the look. So spend time on finding the fingerprints of your project. Don't come and sort of pitch yet another TV show for 3 to 5 years old kids about friendship and it, you know, looking like Peppa Pig, you know, that's fine. You know, it needs to be unique because there's so many talented people and there's so many projects. And if you're doing something that looks like 10 other things that've been pitched the same day, no one will remember you. That's the sad truth. So it needs to stand out.
Yeah. I like also what you're talking about, thumbprint, like finding it for your project. You guys having made, you know, multiple short films and, you know, your two features, like none of them really look alike. It's all the production design you choose, like supports the story you're trying to tell. So that's really smart. That makes so much sense.
Exactly. And I get so bored, I have to say, with a lot of, especially a lot of CGI, you know, it all looks like, you know, it's masterfully done, but it looks, everything looks the same. And the story is the same as well. And I get so bored and frustrated as a spectator, you know, I mean, you know, we can, with animation, that's the thing with animation. That's the thing that sets us aside from live action, is that we can do anything. And we always create a world from a blank page. We can go in every direction. Absolutely. And why then do we end up going in the same direction? You know, it's basically, you know, because we're using the same tools and it's, you can rig the character in the same way as the other character. And that's why it makes sense that they have the same volumes and blah, blah, blah. But come on, you can do anything. And that's what makes people take interest as well. You know, you want to see something fresh and you want to see something unique. And
like, how long did it take you to kind of adapt to this world? You mentioned that, you know, animation wasn't really the goal at the start. It was more, you know, film, but you were like nervous to dive in. So like, how did you get comfortable with like owning your authority as you became a leader?
That took quite a few years. I started as a production manager probably 12 years ago, and then I've been a producer for 10 years. You know, it took maybe some time between 5 and 7 years.
Do you remember any pivotal moments where like you had to let go of maybe narratives you were telling yourself that weren't serving you anymore? Like, oh, I can't be nervous or afraid anymore. I really need to do my job.
Yeah, but I was never sort of nervous on my job. You know, I was never, it wasn't like that. But it wasn't like that. And I work at a small company where we're all very friendly. And I've never sort of tried to fake anything or, you know, be afraid that everyone would know all the things I didn't know, etc. But I don't think I can sort of give you a defined moment, but what I can do is sort of to say that, well, it's still, you know, animation is so complex and it's so big. And because I'm not an animator myself and I'm not a very technical person either, I come to terms with the fact that there's a lot of things that I would never understand fully. So it's more about sort of building confidence in the stuff that I know how to do and they don't, and then sort of be very open and humble about all the things that I don't understand, so that you know, I don't try to come across as more artistically or technically competent than I am, because that wouldn't serve any of us. And then at some point you understand that, you know, I'm pretty good at this. You know, this the producing is super hard, and it's so many things that I'm still not good enough at. Like all the law, you know, law side of thing, for instance. But that's also services that you can sort of buy. You can pay someone to do those things for you. There's probably 20 different ways of being a good producer, you know, and no producer I know masters every part of the job. You know, some are brilliant in one area and but quite crappy at stuff that I'm good at. Then I do the stuff that I'm good at, I do myself, and the stuff that I'm not good at, I leave to Lisa, my partner, who's a lot better than me at a lot of things and much more experienced. You know, she has been in animation for 30 years, or I call my other colleagues or a lawyer or whatever to get help.
Yeah, that's good to know. It's like, you don't have to know everything. You have support and you just have to ask for help or ask your questions for support. Yes,
and then you also have a producer guilds, you know, and I think producers, at least, I don't know how it is in the US, but probably the US is much more competitive, I would guess. But here we, you know, we're colleagues. So if I'm curious about something, I can always just call a producer colleague from a competing company and they will help me. And I also get calls from them, you know, and I'm being transparent and helpful back. And it's, yeah.
I love that. So you had mentioned it earlier that, you know, you nurture talent within the studio. So like, how do you do that? What resources do you give them?
No, you need to let people start with something small, you know, and then when they are ready to grow, you need to give them lots of support. That's basically it. You know, it's no abracadabra. We have, for instance, now we have a very, very, very talented artist who has been working with us for some time. And we understood very early on that she also had the aspirations of becoming a director, you know, because you understand that from a person quite early on. And she's been doing other work for us on and off for a couple of years. But now, you know, we always knew that she wanted to become a director. And now we had a smaller commission thing we're doing. And then that was natural to sort of ask her if she wanted to try that as a director. And so it's just give a gentle push in the direction they want to go, and then but then with smaller tasks. And then hopefully, or this is going really well from what I understand. It's not my project, but I think it's going really well. And then next time, you know, she will be ready to do a short film, and then in a couple of short films she might be ready to do a feature. And it's the same with we're developing three new features now, and two of them are by directors who are already feature film directors, Kajsa with Titina, and then and another director, and then the third one, she's one of our in-house people who's been working here as an illustrator for many years, but also as a director for commissioned work and also for short films. And now she's going to make her feature film debut. But that's also, you know, because we've been working side by side now for 10 years. So sort of feeling that she's, you know, that she's ready for it, and it's her project, and she's the only one who can make it. You know, it's so her in every way. And then it's all about giving her the support. So we're talking about that a lot. You know, we understand it's a big project, so that she will need to have a co-director, you know, make sure that we sort of build a system around her so that she won't, that it's impossible to fail, because there's, you know, more people sharing the responsibility. And I'm sure she's going to do brilliantly.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I love how you support them. So because like you often hire artists and, you know, production people, a lot of, you know, over here in Assembly, to an extent over there too, it's very gig to gig, like, you know, working in animation. So like, we're constantly having interviews, you know, up to a point. Like, I know sometimes you might get a job without the interview because your track record's like really good and people have worked with you before, but when you're starting out, it is a lot of interviews. So do you have any advice? What do you look for in candidates? And also, like, how do you tell that they're a good fit?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, but of course the most important thing is the portfolio, to make sure that you have a really good portfolio. It's better to take out stuff that you're not that happy with. That's more important than having, you know, as many projects as possible.
Mm-hmm, totally.
So I think that's the biggest thing, to have like a really good portfolio. And then I think also in animation, there's a lot of humble people and timid and a little bit shy, which is okay. I think it doesn't matter. You don't need to sort of try to become more extrovert, and, you know, it's fine to be the way you are, as long as you're sort of nice. When you get the chance to go somewhere, but just be nice and polite and humble. And especially if you're starting out, you know, be humble and open, and make sure that you learn from the seniors and the people who've been there, because everyone likes people who are openly saying that, you know, I think you're doing great work, and I would, you know, if you have any tips for me, if you have ideas how I can improve, you know, instead of, you know, coming in there and trying to act as if you already know everything. So I think that's important. And also, you know, just the basic things like show up on time, you know.
Yeah.
If you're ill, that's okay, but let us know on time. and be like a good worker, you know, like put in the hours and the effort, and let people understand that you enjoy what you're doing there. And basically it's about the portfolio. But I think it's probably very different in the US as well, because there's so many gigs, and there's also so many people. Well, here, you know, for us, it's always a struggle to find we get a lot of portfolios, and we are not always we're not always good at answering people on time, etc. But when we are looking specifically for 2D animators, for instance, or art directors, it's the problem is usually the reverse. It's hard to find the right people that are good enough, talented enough. It's not that many.
Yeah, and with like animation artists, they're kind of like Swiss Army knives, you know, generalists in most cases, at least over here. Like, because you have to adapt to the style of the project. But then there's some people who are more illustrators who have a specific style. So I'm sure like that comes into play as well, where like you might hire someone because you like their style over like their ability to adapt, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that happens.
Yeah, that's
really cool. We do that with typecast, and we know that, you know, because there's people that we work with, you know, freelancers, and then when we get a new project, you know, we think about, oh, but this would be a good fit for Annette. That's sort of her thing, and then we'll call her. But we wouldn't call her for other things because we know that she's brilliant, sort of within her world. But yeah,
you know, because like the environment is like, you know, adapt and be a generalist, but at the same time, like talking about the person you just mentioned, having like a niche, you know, like a very specific realm of what they do best. I feel like it can be sometimes hard as like the person facing the industry. Like, what should I do? Like, should I adapt and work more, or should I find the niche that people come to me for? Do you have any opinion on that?
Not really, but I think, the most important thing is that it's nice work. If you have the possibility of doing different styles, if that's sort of within your range, then definitely make sure your portfolio is eclectic. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good thing. Then we know we could use you for more things. It's great. But if that's impossible for you, if you're so locked in one way of working, I mean, there's so many examples of brilliant illustrators that only do, you know, one style, and that's fine as well.
So along your path in your career, have you ever had to overcome some kind of obstacle?
Well, there's obstacles every day in a way,
yeah.
You know, in one way or the other. But like a huge obstacle. No, I think it was when we started Titina, it was difficult because the project was so huge, and we had done, you know, 30 plus short films at the company. I hadn't done that many. I think I've produced, I don't know how many short films I've produced, maybe 12, 13, something like that.
And that's a lot. 30 or 12, that's a lot.
Yeah, but anyway, but and then we did this other feature that we co-produced, the Ape Star, but it was difficult to get people, and especially the people financing us, the Film Institute, to believe that we could pull off something this big and this complex, to give them sort of reason to, because it's, you know, it's a lot of money, and when in the US, you know, it's private money, but in Europe it's largely public money. So, you know, we're making film paid by taxpayers, you know, and that's a very, very big responsibility. Mm-hmm. So it's public money. You need to sort of take that seriously. It could have gone into building better kindergartens instead. So we had to overcome sort of their skepticism. But I think the way we did it was to, again, as I said before, if there's stuff you don't know how to do well enough, then ask someone. So what we did was that we attached to super experienced producers as sort of executive producers. And what they did was basically to sit down with us 2 hours once a month and just, you know, check in on how things are going and pushing us. And have you thought about this? Are you on time with that? Isn't it about time that you talk to this and that, you know? So someone who has done, one of them had done animation before. The other one has never done animation, but he's produced, I don't know how many feature films. I have lost count. There's so many. So he's like super experienced. To have sort of that support that gave the Film Institute belief, I think, or made them feel confident that we could pull it off. So, but it took actually, it took a couple of years, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I hadn't thought about that before, about how, like, you know, talking about public money. And I think this is how the film institutes work, right? Like, you're representing your whole country, like, artistically, right? And it goes out into the world. I don't know. That just feels like it'd probably be kind of daunting.
Yeah, but it's also something we take pride in. And I don't try to think about it that much, that I'm representing Norway in a way. But what I feel is that we're sort of representing Norwegian traditions and Norwegian history, Norwegian values, that we do stuff differently, that we tell different kinds of stories with other moral compasses. We are maybe a little bit edgier, politically different. So I think, and I to me, that's it's not daunting. It's it makes me proud.
Very cool. As a wrap up here, like, what is a piece of advice you can leave with the audience
in general for their life?
Yeah, for their life, for their creative life in animation,
for their creative life. no, I think animation can be really, really hard, but it's also really, really fun. So if you don't have fun in your current position, then maybe you should change your position. And you need to have patience in one way, you know, because it takes a long time to do animation and it takes a long time to build a career. So if you're an animator today, but you feel like you have the potential of becoming a director, then of course you need to do the steps and be patient in order to get where you want. But also don't compromise too much, because suddenly there's a blink and there's 15 years passed and you've spent all your time working on someone else's vision and you have a lot of things within yourself that needs to come out, then I think that can probably make you quite unhappy. So if you have that, and a lot of animators are just beautiful animators and they don't have the need to do something other than that, and they don't have the need to create something for themselves. And if so, that's fine. But if you do have the need to create something for yourself, make sure that you don't put that aside for like decades and decades, you know. And it could be, you could start on a small scale, you know. It doesn't need to be an animated film. You can do a little picture book, or you can try to do comics, but make sure that you do something for yourself as well and not only for others.
I love that. Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a great conversation. I know it was probably like more focused on producing, so thank you for going there with me. It's just so interesting to hear how, like, because it's one thing to make art, but then people need to see it. So that was really inspiring to hear about.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here. And I think that's our main task as producers, is sort of facilitating other people's art and getting it out there in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. When you see the final picture, is it like a memory book of the whole process, and you see like decisions that you helped, you know, make, or you made yourself on the screen?
Absolutely. A lot. And a lot of things you take pride in. And there's always sort of some things that make you squint a little bit and you say, oh, I knew that we should have done that differently and that wasn't really good enough, or blah, blah, blah. But the funny thing is that when a film is just, you know, completed, like, then you watch it and you're very critical and you go like, oh, you know, that background didn't really match up with that, and the animation in that scene is not really good enough, and it's the music is too loud in this sequence, and you have all these things that, you know, makes you really annoyed. But then if you leave the film for a couple of years and then you revisit it, then it's a very different experience, and I'm much less critical, and just you have more just the joy and pride.
Yeah, I love that. Watching it, I didn't feel any of those things, just so you know. I didn't see any flaw.
No, but you know it when it's there. I have, but usually, well, actually with Tatiana, we worked so hard. So it's not that many things that irritates me there. It's very few things, actually.
That's great.
I'm very proud of that film. But there, it's a couple of things. I won't point them out because then other people will notice. So I will keep it to myself. But I look forward to now watching the film again in maybe, well, I watched it so many times now, and it's not that long ago since I watched it last, but I want to sort of leave it now and leave it on the shelf for maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years and then watch it again. And then I think it will be, I will be very moved. It will be an emotional and a proud moment, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's a beautiful piece of art. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing.
Thank you, Cassie.
Ink and Paint Folk is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by the year 2025. Learn more about womeninanimation.org. This episode was produced by me, Cassie Soliday, with the magic of the internet. Music by Dominique Parker. Edited by Daniel Wachorik. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk podcast. Stay colorful.